Kalorama, a Recorded Books Highbridge imprint, presents Swing Hard in Case You Hit It, My Escape from Addiction and Shot at Redemption on the Trump Campaign, by Tim Murtaugh. Read by Tim Murtaugh and Tom Parks. Preface. This book will probably be unlike any other you've listened to by someone in politics. It has some stories from inside the Trump 2020 presidential re-election campaign, but it's not totally about that race, or Donald J. Trump, for that matter. It's about the path that I took, starting early in life, and the poor choices that I made that eventually threatened to ruin everything I had tried to achieve over my first 45 years on this planet. It's about going to jail, twice, because I couldn't stop guzzling alcohol. And it's about very nearly losing my loving wife, my career, and all my self-respect, and still somehow recovering to hold a prominent job for the President of the United States less than 4 years later. It's also about some of my political life after I quit drinking. In the following chapters, you'll hear about some of my experiences as the communications director for the Trump 2020 campaign, some good and some bad. But unlike a lot of political books of this era, it won't be about bashing Donald Trump or making headlines by spilling juicy gossip. I am proud to have worked for President Trump and proud to have run comms on his re-election campaign. To have been trusted with that responsibility remains the highest honor of my professional career. But that's not to say that all the campaign stories contained herein are happy ones. Far from it, in fact. So this is a redemption story, I suppose, although, according to many people on Twitter or X, I am well beyond hope for that because I worked for Trump. But it's also a story about someone, me, who had to be battered about the head with the same lessons over and over and over until one day they finally registered when I was faced with no other choice. So, redemption, yes, but it took an awfully long time, and at least professionally, it wasn't exactly the perfect ending. Either way, while writing the first draft of the manuscript for this book, I marked 8 years since my last drink. It's also a cautionary tale because I bet there are many people, in politics or not, who can hear my story and recognize much of themselves in the ridiculous and self-sabotaging behavior in which I engaged for too many years. I know from my own experience that each time I was in rehab, and yes, I went multiple times, I was a regular at the bookstore, buying and devouring all the titles that were more biographical than clinical. I much preferred reading about the real struggles that people experienced and how they made it through them, and I'm sure there are many other alcoholics who feel the same way. My incredibly helpful, dedicated, and forgiving wife, Dina Kozanis, first encouraged me to write a book of this nature several years ago. It always sounded like a good idea, but I never thought I'd really do it. Dina is a private person and doesn't relish these details becoming public, but at the same time, she knows that it's a story that can possibly help other people. She witnessed much of my personal war with alcohol, and I can state unequivocally and without exaggeration that without her in my life, I would either be in jail or dead today. I know that she has suffered greatly as well and continues to be haunted by memories of how I used to be. A reminder that the people closest to active alcoholics often have it worse than the alcoholics themselves. It was imperative that she was on board with my writing this book, and I think it's good that she was, because I believe she turns out to be the hero of the story. In some ways, this book is a defense-by-offense move for me, because telling on myself in this way means that I've revealed it on my terms, and my past will no longer have the power that dark secrets sometimes have. I have consciously not included every episode that I might, because as alcoholics in recovery, we're not supposed to unburden ourselves of these things if there's the potential to hurt other people by bringing them up. I truly hope that hearing about what I went through can help another alcoholic to get closer to being sober. I know that writing it all down for once certainly helped me to continue to avoid drinking, one day at a time, because I was reminded of how farcical my whole existence once was. But I don't think that you have to be a drunk to appreciate the stories in here or to just shake your head. The way I decided to go about writing this book is with two different timelines, one during my drinking days and the other after I had dried out, which was less than 4 years before I joined the Trump campaign. This made sense to me because there were really two different lives, the drinking me versus the sober me, and the story alternates between the two, with a note of my drinking status at the beginning of each section. While I was writing, I tried to follow the advice my father always gave me before baseball practice: swing hard, in case you hit it. That's good counsel for all aspects of life, if you think about it, and it's what I'm trying to do with this book. Anyway, here's my story. Tim Murtaugh, Leesburg, Virginia, September 2023.
Introduction. Sober, Battle Creek, Michigan, December 18th, 2019. A week before Christmas 2019, it was a bitterly cold Wednesday night in Battle Creek, Michigan. Windy, with temperatures in the teens most of the day. Inside Kellogg Arena, a multi-purpose facility with a capacity listed at 6,200, thousands of supporters of President Donald J. Trump filled the seats to the rafters and flooded the floor in front of the stage that would be the epicenter of the coming rally. As they awaited what everyone suspected would be an especially fiery Trump speech, the crowd rocked out to the pre-rally playlist and kept the arena warm through body heat. It would soon get hotter. The Trump 2020 campaign roadshow had roared into town on that night, like it had in so many other places on so many other nights, but this time it was different. This time, the President of the United States was going to be impeached by the House of Representatives back in Washington, D.C., at roughly the same time that he was expected to step up to the microphone in Michigan. Except there was uncertainty backstage, where I stood with President Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, and a variety of senior officials from the White House and re-election campaign. A monitor was tuned to Fox News, which showed the live feed from the House floor at the Capitol. A determination had to be made. Should Trump begin speaking as scheduled, or should he wait for the final votes before going on stage? Waiting for the votes to conclude carried risk as far as the timing of the rally went, because there was no telling how long the voting would take, and it was not reasonable to delay the president's remarks indefinitely. Yet, if Trump took the stage while the vote was underway, it was unclear how the news of the result would reach him mid-speech. Some in the media had theorized that the Trump campaign had engineered this made-for-television split-screen moment. I know this because I had become the communications director for the president's re-election campaign in February of that year, and I had heard the speculation. To be fair, it seemed like classic Trump showmanship. To beg coverage of his defiant remarks to raucous supporters juxtaposed with the solemn images from the House chamber. But the truth was that the rally had been planned and scheduled well before anyone knew when Speaker Nancy Pelosi would schedule the impeachment votes. It was more likely that Pelosi had set the date and time of the votes with the rally in mind. Regardless, the fact remained that the Trump speech and the impeachment votes were on a collision course timing-wise. There was discussion backstage among President Trump, campaign manager Brad Parscale, White House advisor Stephen Miller, and others, including Vice President Mike Pence, who also had made the trip to Michigan for this important night. As someone who was relatively new to the higher rungs of Trump world at the time, I mostly watched, listened, and just tried to take in every aspect of what was clearly a monumental night in American history. I quietly took a few pictures of the scene with my phone as the decision was made. Trump would take the stage, and we would send someone out to signal him with the news when the vote was final. The familiar strains of Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA, Trump's signature entrance music, blared from the loudspeakers. The President of the United States made his slow approach to the lectern, stopping periodically, waving to his fans, pointing to individuals in the crowd, and clapping along with them. This was quintessential Trump, milking every second of his walk-up song and delighting the thousands of screaming supporters. Once he arrived at the microphone, he got rolling and didn't waste any time before tearing into Pelosi and the Democrats in Washington. Crazy Nancy Pelosi's House Democrats have branded themselves with an eternal mark of shame, Trump told the roaring crowd. It's a disgrace. After 3 years of sinister witch hunts, hoaxes, and scams, tonight the House Democrats are trying to nullify the ballots of tens of millions of patriotic Americans, Trump said, accusing Democrats of interfering in America's elections and subverting American democracy. At this exact moment, the House was voting to impeach him on two counts involving his dealings with Ukraine, accusing him of abusing his power to pressure the Ukrainian president to investigate Democratic candidate Joe Biden and then obstructing congressional investigations of the matter. I stood backstage, simply marveling at the very fact that I was present for the historic event and watching the silent television feed of the impeachment proceedings with the vice president standing immediately to my right. In front of us, behind the monitor, rose a broad and tall black curtain separating us from the bowl of the arena. On the other side of the pipe and drape rigging, the man who would soon be impeached was delivering the speech that was meant to harness Republican anger at the development and turn it into a potent campaign weapon. The air felt heavy with the gravity of the simultaneous events, and for me, to experience it standing next to the vice president on one side of the curtain, while listening to the president speak from the other, it was a true remember where you were moment, and I was right there where it was all happening. When the voting was finished, the House had impeached Trump on both counts. On the charge of abuse of power, the vote was 230 in favor to 197 against, with two Democrats, Colin Peterson and Jeff Van Drew, siding with all Republicans, and another Democrat, Tulsi Gabbard, voting present. On the charge of obstructing Congress, the vote was 229 in favor to 198 against, with three Democrats, Peterson, Van Drew, and Jared Golden, siding with all Republicans, and Gabbard voting present again. And now, the word had to get to Trump, who had worked the crowd into a full lather. White House Deputy Press Secretary Hogan Gidley, who would leave the administration to join the Trump re-election campaign in June 2020, began assembling a large sign to alert Trump to the news, with White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham observing, Gidley used equipment in a makeshift office area to print large numbers on individual pieces of paper, which he then affixed to a large poster board. Understanding that this one-way communication to the president on stage had to be succinct, Gidley's poster would only describe one of the two impeachment votes, and he chose the second one because a larger number of Democrats had defected to support Trump. The finished product had two lines of numbers. The first line read 229 to 198, referring to the breakdown of yeas and nays. The second line simply read 3, referring to the number of Democrats who had defected to oppose the impeachment. The method of delivery seemed obvious, and the task was given to campaign press secretary Kayleigh McEnany, who would later leave the campaign to become White House press secretary, replacing Grisham in April 2020. Tall, with long blonde hair, wearing a bright orange dress, and recognizable to Trump by sight, McEnany would be easy to spot in the buffer area between the front of the stage and the crowd. She walked out from the backstage area and took a position in front of Trump and slightly to his left, holding the sign in front of her so he could easily see it. "Oh, I think we have a vote coming in," Trump said, immediately spotting McEnany. "So we got every single Republican voted for us. Whoa, wow, wow, almost 200. So we had 198, 229, 198. We didn't lose one Republican vote, and three Democrats voted for us." That's the story of how the 45th president of the United States learned that he had become just the third president in history to be impeached. As the rally concluded, after a speech that timed out to be his longest rally speech to that point at just over 2 hours, the feeling inside the campaign was that the impeachment would ultimately work in the president's favor politically. The charges were flimsy and transparently partisan. The campaign had long believed that the Democrats were overreaching, that they could be easily depicted as D.C. elitists attempting to thwart the will of the people, who strongly supported Trump's policies. If, as expected, the Senate acquitted Trump of the charges, as it would do on February 5, 2020. The impeachment would be used to galvanize his supporters and cast the entire election as the Washington swamp pitted against normal everyday citizens. At the time, we couldn't have known that this would only be the first of two impeachments of President Donald J. Trump, or that a global pandemic would strike just a few months later, prompting lockdowns, school closures, and economic calamity, and eventually killing more than a million Americans. The COVID-19 plague that swept the planet completely disrupted the campaign and became the undeniable top issue, dwarfing impeachments and any other topic, canceling rallies and most public events, and allowing eventual Democratic nominee Joe Biden to avoid public appearances and largely campaign from his basement in Wilmington, Delaware. We couldn't have known that a laptop owned by Biden's son, Hunter, would surface to reveal information that tied the father to the son's influence-peddling schemes involving foreign moneymen, or that social media platforms and the national news media would combine to suppress the story as the campaign drew to a close in November 2020. We couldn't have known that an unruly mob would storm the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, as Congress met to certify a Biden victory, leading to that second impeachment and another acquittal. And we couldn't have known that the election of 2020 would drag on for years beyond Election Day, with the Congressional January 6th Committee investigation and hearings and a subsequent Department of Justice investigation and grand jury. None of those things was knowable 7 days before Christmas 2019, when it seemed like the events of December 18th would resonate and dominate for the length of the campaign. What I did know was that for me, personally, the experience that night in Battle Creek was exhilarating. I had spent many years in politics, on campaigns and with political committees at the state and national levels. But that impeachment night rally was not something I had ever expected to witness from inside the inner bubble at a presidential event. For someone involved in political communications as a career, this was the top of the professional mountain. It's not an exaggeration to say that the 2020 American presidential election was the most watched political campaign in world history, and I was the communications director for the incumbent. But I felt like an unlikely participant, and the feeling was especially strong because not many years earlier, I had been on a decidedly different and destructive and dangerous path. Not long before that night in Battle Creek, I had been in another situation that was difficult for entirely different reasons. Drinking, May 16, 2015, Fairfax County, Virginia. When I began to come to, I knew I was in trouble before I even opened my eyes. There was the familiar feeling of fogginess, the awareness that I had gotten impossibly drunk again, and the immediate rush of shame for letting it happen once more. But it all came with recognizable additions, the institutional vibrations and atmosphere of my physical surroundings, and that presented a bigger problem. I knew what it meant because I'd been in such places before. A dull ache in the back of my head told me that I was lying on a hard floor, and I could tell that I had my feet propped up on a hard chair of some kind. My hands found my face, and I felt around for fresh wounds or blood. Injuries had happened in the past, and finding none, I opened my eyes. I've heard it said in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that often we problem drinkers don't wake up from sleeping one off as much as we come to, and that's exactly what happened to me that day. I sat up, still on the floor, and took it in. A holding room in what was certainly a police station. There were rows of plastic chairs joined together by armrests to prevent anyone from lying down across several seats, which was evidently why I had been passed out with my head on the floor. Bolted to the ceiling was a television, somewhat loudly playing a program I don't recall today. Around me, other men were engaged in various methods of doing nothing. Some slumped awkwardly in the chairs, some slept, some watched TV. Still others stood at the one wall, that consisted mostly of plexiglass windows and looked out into a common area of some kind. Almost no one in the room was talking, as far as I could tell. I decided to risk standing up. Using the row of plastic chairs to steady myself, I rose to my feet to test my equilibrium. Once upright, I walked over to the wall of windows without incident. I could see another, larger room on the other side of the partition. There were cops out there. Lots of them. Some looked like they were doing paperwork, and some were interviewing sad-looking people who would probably be joining us in the smaller room shortly. For some reason, I felt compelled to reach with my hand to feel my pockets, knowing what I would find, rather what I would not find, as the case was. My wallet was missing. I patted both front pockets. No cell phone. Looking down, I saw that my shoes were gone as well, and lifting my shirt, I discovered that I was beltless also. There was a guy standing near me by the window. "Where are we?" I asked him. "Fairfax," he said. "Fairfax what?" "Fairfax County Jail," he said, and moved away. I didn't feel hungover yet, because I was undoubtedly still quite drunk, but I thought sitting down for a while would feel much better than standing. As I found a spot on a hard plastic chair, I tried to take stock of what I knew. I had quite clearly been arrested, no doubt for an alcohol-related offense. I was being held in a large holding room in what I would learn was the Adult Detention Center at the Fairfax County Judicial Center. I wasn't wearing handcuffs, but all my personal belongings had been confiscated. At least I wasn't injured. I was not panicked because I had been in similar situations before. It's not something to be proud of, but the fact that I'd been arrested before probably helped me to stay calm while I assessed my situation. There was a booth toward the back of the room that contained a payphone, but there wasn't anyone I was brave enough to call just yet. A sudden realization hit me, and I sat bolt upright in the plastic chair, feeling real shock register. I mean, I could feel it through my arms and into my fingers, down my legs and into my feet, like a real electrical jolt. Some synapses had fired, and I had made the connection between this arrest and one of my other ones. I was in serious trouble, more than ever before, for sure. Because of an earlier DUI conviction, my second, I had served 10 days in jail and was still on probation, with 80 days of suspended jail time hanging over my head. If I were convicted of another alcohol-related criminal offense while still under the court's supervision, that sentence would come crashing down on me, and I would go to jail for all of the 80 days. It would likely end my new marriage and my career, and it would seriously jeopardize all relationships with family and friends. It would be a complete and total disaster, and my life, as I had known it, would effectively be over. "Oh, shit," I said to myself as a cold sweat broke out on my forehead. "Shit, shit, shit." I stood up and walked back over to the windows, peering at the officers on the other side, some of whom were talking good-naturedly to each other. I tentatively tapped on the glass to try to gently get their attention. One of them looked at me and paused, seeming to take a second to decide if I was worth the effort of standing up and walking over. After a moment, he moved to the door and opened a slot. "Yeah," he said. "Can you tell me what I'm charged with, and if I'm going to be released?" I asked as politely as I could. "Name?" "Timothy Michael Murtaugh," I said. "Hang on," he said, and went back to a desk for a moment. When he returned, he had an answer. "You gotta sober up, and then we'll process you out," he said. "You have to get under the legal limit. Might be a few hours. We'll test you after a while." "And what am I charged with?" I asked. "Public intoxication." "Okay," I said, and then had a thought about my personal possessions. "Do you guys have my wallet and phone and stuff?" "It would have been taken from you and placed in a bag until you're released," he explained. "Right, but I'm wondering about one thing. I had a coin about the size of a silver dollar?" I said. "It's a commemorative coin that has my grandfather's face on it. I had it in my left back pocket and it's gone. I wanted to make sure you have it and that I didn't lose it somewhere else." He didn't answer, so I continued. "It's my good luck charm," I said. We made eye contact through the window as I looked at him with what I imagined was a pathetic expression. "It didn't work," he said. Chapter 1. Drinking. Blackout drunk. High school and college. The first time I got blackout drunk was at my buddy Mike Fisher's house, either sophomore or junior year of high school. Mike, with whom I'm still close friends today, lived just a few blocks away from my house in our small suburban Philadelphia town of Folsom, within Ridley Township in Delaware County, Pennsylvania. It was a mostly blue-collar town and a perfectly fine place to grow up. I lived with my parents, Tim and Janet Murtaugh, and my brother Steve, who was 6 years younger. My mother's parents, Harry and Alice Cotton, lived in the same neighborhood as we did, and my dad's mother, Kathleen, lived in the neighboring community of Woodland. My paternal grandfather, Danny Murtaugh, had died in 1976, but had been a local celebrity as the successful manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates in Major League Baseball and a two-time winner of the World Series. His name was still very well known locally, even many years later, and it was his face on a coin, a collectible produced by the Pirates, that I carried with me as a good luck piece. My father retired as an Allstate insurance agent, but he had spent his younger years chasing his own baseball dreams as a catcher and then as a manager in the Pirates system. My mother had been a nurse and then worked with my dad at the insurance office. I was not keenly aware of it at all times, but my father was an active alcoholic for years, until he stopped drinking when I was a freshman in college. But while I was in high school one weekend, Mike's mother was away. His father had died while we were in elementary school, which meant there was an available house for a party of sorts. A group of guys got together at his place and raided the bar, though Mike himself didn't drink. Someone made a large cocktail in a pint glass that had a lot of different things dumped into it, including green creme de menthe, and one of the guys dubbed it the Christmas tree. There was another offensive concoction that someone else called a flying fuck at the moon. Nasty as they were, I guess I drank quite enough of them, and probably a bunch of other stuff, because I got really intoxicated and don't remember much of the evening. Naturally, I had told my parents that I was staying over at Mike's, neglecting to mention that his mother wasn't home. All of us slept on the floor with sleeping bags, and I woke up to a tremendous hangover. As I waded through the fog in my brain, I tried to put together some pieces of memory, but was having a hard time making anything coherent out of it. I did recall that some of the guys had subjected me to a kind of interview the night before. I remember being asked questions about some of our classmates at school as the guys tried to draw out my opinions of various people. More concerned with feeling physically terrible and how I would describe the previous evening to my parents, I didn't think much about this interview at the time. On Monday, I had recovered and the hangover was mostly forgotten by the time I got to school. But that's when the antics of Friday night came back on me with vengeance, and I experienced an alcoholic's embarrassment and remorse for the first time. Unbeknownst to me, while I was seriously inebriated, Mike and the other guys had produced a cassette tape recorder, remember this was the mid to late 1980s, and had documented my answers to their questions. The commentary was not something I wanted my classmates to hear, but Mike had brought it to school. Of course, I was pretty pissed at Mike and the rest of the guys for humiliating me that way. But now, with the benefit of years of experience with embarrassing situations caused by my alcohol consumption, I know that I gave them the ammunition. If I hadn't gotten completely shit-faced and overridden my verbal filter, there would have been no embarrassing tape. Perversely, it occurs to me now that I should have been grateful for what I perceived back then as a shocking betrayal by friends. They were showing me that nothing good comes from getting blind drunk, and a person other than me might have used the incident.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?